Beautifully done, choir. All joys of shouts as these days of unleavened bread are coming to a close. We're very thankful for all the many lessons and themes. Before I get to the handout, I'll talk a little bit about some of the themes of the holy days to see if everyone here has had similar experiences. The first theme of the days of unleavened bread that I think is really important is the idea of finding hidden sin. So we live in a society that sin is not talked about. People might make mistakes, or there might be places where people fall down, but we don't like to use the term sin, especially the idea of intentional sin. But in God's church, every year we have the opportunity through the Days of Unleavened Bread to be hunting for sin like leaven that could be hidden. And every once in a while, you'll find something like a donut that's stuffed under a cushion somewhere that you might have missed. And it's an awesome lesson because it helps to show us that you never know where sin might be hiding. And again, this is a special time when we get to focus on hunting out the sin that might be in our lives that we need to work on. It also gives us a chance, another theme of the Days of Unleavened Bread, to walk in an unleavened life. And so again, we have the opportunity by taking in the unleavened bread of Christ in our lives to seek to walk as Christ did, without leaven, without sin. And hopefully, in the last 7 days, we've had a chance to be practicing that. Another theme of the Days of Unleavened Bread is the idea of overcoming our adversary. Again, Moses had Pharaoh to contend with. We have Satan the devil to contend with, and all the evil influences that he brings to the world around us. And so part of the Days of Unleavened Bread is just confronting the adversary that we face and dealing with it. Again, we can only do that through Christ, but as we again, imbibe the unleavened bread of Christ, we understand that Satan and his sinful ways are not what we want in our lives, and they're not what's going to bring us ultimate happiness. There might be, a temporary thrill that people might get from sin, but it's not permanent. And the Days of Unleavened Bread help us to learn that. We also learn to trust God during the Days of Unleavened Bread. Because only God can cause that death angel to pass over the houses. So Israel, for a period of time, suffered along with the Egyptians. But there's then a period of time during the days, the plagues that occurred in Israel, in Egypt, that Israel was spared. And by trusting God, whether it was at the time of the Passover, where you had to put blood on your doorposts or the firstborn would die, or when they were leaving Egypt, they were trusting God because, again, Pharaoh ended up chasing after them. Another theme is God's choosing to make a difference. He does that back with Israel. As mentioned, some of the plagues never happened to Israel. They did happen to Egypt. And in our lives, hopefully we can see times when God has reached out and helped us, where he doesn't necessarily do that for everyone that's around us. And finally, the opportunity of falling and repenting and confessing our sin. So again, during the Days of Unleavened Bread, we live in a society where in our homes we might have unleavened. But out in society, when we go to our jobs and things like that, it's not unleavened out there. And every once in a while you forget that, oh, these are the Days of Unleavened Bread, and you might have eaten the hamburger that was talked about a minute or two ago, or some slip. And again, the lesson that we learn in the Days of Unleavened Bread is that God doesn't reject us and throw us away when we make that kind of slip. Christ's sacrifice is still there for us. And so when we fall, We simply need to repent. We take our sin to Christ, and we use his perfect life as atonement for that sin. And then we continue on. And I'm glad to see so many people here today that came through the days of unleavened bread and are continuing on in their walk with Christ. So to touch now on the handout, I talk about at the beginning, as we contemplate the lessons learned, one thing I appreciate is the chance to learn something fresh and a unique new perspective that are from people who are out there. So in today's message, I wanted to talk about a commentary on the book of Exodus that was written by Dennis Prager just maybe a couple years ago. He actually has a new commentary coming out on the subject of Genesis, and it should be coming out in the next week or two. So he started with Exodus, and again, the days of unleavened bread are heavily covered in the lessons of the book of Exodus. And I wanted to talk to you about his commentary, because he takes a bit of a unique approach that is different from some of the other commentaries that are out there, and I find it really interesting and effective. One thing he does in his commentaries is when he comes to a verse that answers a question, he'll go ahead and tell you what the question is ahead of time. And then you can see, is this actually a Bible answer to this particular question? And so for the message today, I call it Jim's Top 10 Questions and Answers drawn from this new commentary. So the first question that's answered in the commentary, these are in the introductory pages. Did the Exodus happen? For those that were here a couple weeks ago, I spoke about addressing that specific question. And the way that I handled it was to talk about history and archaeology and all the different finds that have existed that help us to prove that the Exodus actually happened. Dennis Prager chose to do a different route. And so it's interesting to see, how can someone else address that question? Well, did the Exodus really happen? So here's how he handled it in his commentary. And again, one of the things I like to challenge you with as we go through some of these questions is, how would you answer that question? So we'll see now how Dennis Prager chose to answer it. He says, many scholars believe Israelites were enslaved in Egypt. Many do not. And that ties in with what I said a couple of weeks ago, where I said most scholars today don't believe the Exodus ever happened. They don't believe Israel was in Egypt. They don't believe they left Egypt. And so that's a challenge. There are strong logical and historical arguments for the Jews having been enslaved in Egypt. One I find particularly compelling was offered by the distinguished scholar Richard Freeman in his commentary on the Exodus. He notes, the Torah repeats one law more than any other, to love the stranger and not to oppress him. And in every case, the Torah adds the words, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Why, Friedman asks, would the Torah make repeated reference to the Israelites being strangers in Egypt if they were never there? Why would one of the greatest Torah moral innovations, the law to love the foreigner, be based on a premise no Israelite could relate to? So it makes perfect sense. That's a good, it's mentioned several times in Exodus. So why would they say that if no one can relate to it? No one in Egypt, in Israel, knows what that would be about. So it makes sense to say that Israel was in Egypt. Similarly, his second reason, why would any people make up origins so lowly as being slaves? No other nation did. And why would the Israelites in the wilderness complain that they ate better in Egypt if they were never there? Of course, one could argue this was made up out of whole cloth. But if it never happened, why bother making that story up? Usually people would make up a really neat story about what their origins were. Second question that he addresses is the idea of, why was this commentary written? Because, we have the choice. I know I probably on my computer have about 40 or 50 different commentaries. Anyhow, there's probably even more than that. Lots of people write commentaries, and there's more commentaries than we could ever get a chance to read. So why was this one written? And is this something that might motivate you to be interested in reading this commentary yourself? So it says, because so much wisdom in the Torah is indispensable. So the reason he wrote it is because there's so much wisdom in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. However, we live in an age that not only has little wisdom, but doesn't even have many people who value it. People greatly value knowledge and intelligence, but not wisdom. And the lack of wisdom, certainly in America and the rest of the West, is directly related to the decline in biblical literacy. In the American past, virtually every home, no matter how poor, owned a Bible, and it was the primary vehicle by which parents passed wisdom onto their children. In the modern period, however, people have increasingly replaced Bible-based homes, Bible-based schools, with godless homes, and with schools in which the Bible is never referred to. As a result, we are less wise and more morally confused. As I show in my discussion of secular education as a potential false god, the best wise and more morally the best educated in the West often have both lacked wisdom and been among the greatest supporters of evil ideologies and regimes. So the lack of reading the Bible in the West, and again, even making it, you know, banned from being taught in the schools, banned from being referred to in schools, in case someone would accuse you of teaching the Bible, has caused a lack in wisdom in people, and it makes people susceptible to be supporting other goofy ideas that are out there, whether it's the ideas of socialism and some of the horrors of people who think that they can make a better society, and they come up with their idea of utopia, and then when they try to put that utopia in effect, it ends up causing lots of unintended consequences that end up in the person becoming a dictator and killing thousands and thousands and millions of people. And that's happened several times in the 20th century. Question 3, in the top 10 list of questions that are answered, is the Torah man-made or God-made, and why it matters? So this is the question that I assume might have happened with each one that's sitting here. You know, is the Bible true? Is the Bible from God, or is it just something that's written by man? And how would you answer that question when somebody confronts you with it? You know, is the Bible made up, or is the Bible from God? And why is that important? Is it important? Does it make a difference if it's from God or from man? And here's how Dennis answers that in his commentary. He says, I'm convinced the Torah is divine, meaning God, not man, is its ultimate source. The Torah is so utterly different, morally, theologically, in terms of wisdom, from anything else preceding it, and for that matter, anything written since, that a reasonable person would have to conclude either moral Superman or God is responsible for it. To cite a few examples of what the Torah introduced to the world, one, a universal God, a God of all the people. This began the long road to human beings believing that there's one Father in heaven and all human beings are brothers and sisters. Before that, other religions didn't teach that. An invisible, incorporeal God. Therefore, the physical is not the only reality. Life is infinitely more than the material world in which we live in during our brief lifetime on earth. A moral God. All gods prior to the Torah were capricious, not moral. Just as moral God means, among other things, ultimately justice will prevail, if not in this life, in the next. It also means human beings imbued with a sense of justice can argue with and question this just God. The name Israel means wrestle with God. So part of what we do in our relationship with God is sometimes we wrestle with God if we don't understand why something has happened the way that it's turning out. Some other reasons that give examples of how the Torah is unique. A God beyond nature. God made nature and therefore not natural. This led to the end of the universal human belief in nature gods, such as rain gods. And sure enough, as belief in the Torah God declines, nature worship seems to be returning. So there's lots of examples of the environmentalists and others who are practicing nature worship. Another point, a God who loves and who wants to be loved. This is another world-changing concept introduced by the Torah to the world. Thank you. Universal human worth. Every human being is created in God's image. Nothing like this has ever been posited prior to the Torah, and it has so much meaning. If we're created in God's image, then every human life has a purpose and needs to be protected. And the last point listed, universal human rights. Another world-altering consequence of universal human worth. So because humans are in God's image, every human has certain rights that should be given to them. So why does it matter whether it was written by God or whether it was written by man? He gives three reasons here why it matters. First, there's no comparison between God commanded. So when someone says God commanded, then you might want to listen to it. Versus Moses commanded, and then whatever follows. So when God commands something, it has a lot more weight and importance and significance than if just some man suggests something. And he goes on and says, if I believe the Ten Commandments were written by men, I would not have honored my parents as much as I did during periods of emotional ambivalence. Those who believe God is the source of the Torah's commandments are far more likely to obey them than those who believe they are man-made. So that's one powerful reason why it matters. Second, only because I believe the Torah is God-made, have I worked to understand and explain difficult passages of the Torah. If you believe the Torah is man-made and you encounter a morally or intellectually problematic verse or passage, you have an easy explanation. Men wrote it, ancient men at that. And you are then free to dismiss it. But for those of us who believe that God wrote the Bible, the Torah, they don't have that option. We need to try to understand the verse or passage morally and intellectually. So again, what difference does it make whether God or man has written the Bible? Well, if man has written it, then you can set aside certain parts that, okay, they messed up on that part. But if God has written it, then you need to research further and try to figure out some of those difficult passages that normally you would just set aside and not worry about. And lastly, only those who believe that the text is God-given will continue to live by it and carefully study it and impart its wisdom to generation after generation. So he goes on to make the point that you're not going to worry as much about passing this on to your kids if it's just written by a man. But if you know that this is God-written wisdom, then you're going to really study it. Question number four. What is the significance of Exodus 1:8? And here he talks about what he calls the indispensable importance of remembering. Exodus 1:8 says, a new king arose in Egypt who did not know Joseph. So here we have the situation where Joseph saved Egypt. He was sent there. God gave him a revelation. And so during years of plenty, they were able to save up their grain. In years of famine, Egypt had grain. And they were the only area among all those nations around them that had grain. So Joseph was a significant savior of the country. But within a period of time, he was not remembered. So it says, Joseph, about whom more is written than any other figure in the Torah except for Moses, interesting fact or statistic that Joseph is, after Moses, the most mentioned person, was the Israelite who rose from slavery, followed by imprisonment, to become the second most powerful man in Egypt. He's credited with saving Egypt from famine. Given that Joseph's role in Egyptian history was so profound, the words, who did not know Joseph, are extraordinary. One of humanity's most common character traits is ingratitude. People either not acknowledging the good another does for them, or quickly forgetting that good. The latter is what this verse describes. Human beings tend to be much more quickly, forget the good that others have done than the bad others have done to them. That's human nature. So we're going to remember, if you did something bad against me, I'm going to remember that. If you did something good for me, well, you know, I might forget about that in a week or two. So it's just human nature to be that way. And so as Christians, one of the things that Exodus is expounding to us here is the idea of, you know, remember. Have gratitude when someone does something good, you know, thank them for it and remember the good that people have done for you. The American writer, Bruce Feller, has an additional insight into this verse, the recurring emphasis on remembering the Torah, specifically the book of Exodus. The story begins with forgetting. So the whole book of Exodus, is chapter 1, verse 8. The Pharaoh does not remember how a son of Israel saved Egypt from famine. And the rest of the five books become an antidote to the state of forgetfulness. God hears to the groaning Israel and remembers his covenant. Moses leads the Israelites from Egypt, urges them to remember this day. The Israelites are ordered to remember the Sabbath day, to observe Passover as a day of remembrance. Exodus 12:14. Moses' goal is to build a counter-Egypt, to construct a society that offers an alternative to ignorance and unknowingness. He must devise a community that remembers. So that's describing Israel, a community that would remember. Remembering the good others have done, the evil that others have done, and one's moral obligations is an indispensable aspect of a good and meaningful life. Because that's one of the lessons that we get from the book of Exodus. Who are we if not our memories? I once interviewed a man who, as a result of a fall on his head, had lost virtually all long-term memory. He did not even remember who his wife and children were. In the interview, he acknowledged that for all intents and purposes, because of his loss of memory, the man who he had been had died. The same holds true for nations. Nations, too, are their memories. A nation that does not remember its past, like the man who fell on his head, ceases to be the nation it was. This may be happening now in a number of Western European nations that teach that their people consider themselves world citizens or Europeans rather than members of a specific nation. It's also happening in the United States, where the level of ignorance of the American past among the Americans is unprecedented. And it's happening in Canada as well, where we have statues of the first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, being taken down. And again, the idea of the past is trying to be erased. And so much of our identity is tied up in that past and the powerful lessons that that past brings to us. Question number 6. God apparently strongly approved of Moses' act of homicide. Exodus 2:12 continued. So this has to do with what Moses did when he saw the Egyptian whipping or beating the Israelite. And it says what Moses did, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Moses killed the Egyptian and buried him. Many people have criticized Moses for this homicide. But what else should Moses have done? Should he have walked away? He would have been turning his back on terrible injustice. Should he have tried to persuade the Egyptian overseer to stop? Hey, stop beating that slave, or stop beating that Hebrew. The idea borders on the absurd. Should he have attacked an Egyptian without killing him? The Egyptian would have either fought back and possibly killed Moses, or informed on Moses, which would have resulted in him being accused of subversion for trying to stop an overseer from punishing a slave. So we're going through the options of what else could Moses have done. He could have just ignored it, turned his back. That wouldn't have been very moral. He could have just tried to fight but not kill him, but he would then be up, you know, he could potentially be killed for fighting, and he could also be put up on charges for trying to block a overseer from punishing a slave. So he goes on and says, clearly, God approved of what Moses did. This is the first of three stories told about Moses to convey what sort of man Moses was, and implicitly, why God chose him to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. To more fully appreciate what Moses did, one should see the film that won the 2013 Academy Award for Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave, especially the scene in which the master whips a slave woman to the brink of death. Watching this scene, one can only wish there was a Moses-like character to do what he did here. In Exodus 2:13, it says, when he went out the next day, he found two Hebrews fighting. So he said to the offender, the word translated here as offender literally means the evil one. The Torah does not hesitate to describe a Jew as evil. Much of the Torah's, the entire Hebrew Bible's greatness and credibility lies in its willingness to critique the Jewish people at the same time. So the Jews' credit, they canonize books that are so critical of them. So Moses' three responses to injustice. Why do you strike your fellow? This is the second of three stories told about Moses before God appears to him. In the first story, he witnesses the injustice and responds by killing. In the second story, when he witnesses an injustice, he spoke. And the next time, he will simply stand. So the next time is when Moses was at the well, and the shepherds were pushing their way in, and they were going to water their sheep with the water that was drawn by the women. And Moses just stood, and the shepherds backed off and let the women water their animals first. Moses is chosen by God, not just because he fights against evil, but because he knows which response is most appropriate in any given situation. Question 7. Did God deprive Pharaoh of free will? So again, many times it's written in Scripture that says that Pharaoh hardened his heart, or that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And again, the criticism of the Bible is, well, what kind of God is fair if he's forcing Pharaoh to reject Moses, what he's requesting, and then he goes ahead and punishes him for what he's doing? So again, it's one of these tough moral dilemmas. How do you address that? Is God fair, or is he unfair because he changes something in Pharaoh's mind, so then Pharaoh has no choice but to do what God is asking of him. In Exodus 4:21 it says, and the Eternal said to Moses, when you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the marvels that I have put within your power. I, however, will stiffen his heart, so he will not let the people go. So when God is stiffening his heart, is it fair that Pharaoh is getting punished for not letting the people go? How do you answer that question? Here's how it's answered in Dennis Prager's commentary. The Torah refers 20 times to the stiffening or hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Half of them are attributed to Pharaoh's decision to harden his heart, and half of them are attributed to God hardening Pharaoh's heart. The latter instances have troubled readers throughout the ages, Is it fair to punish someone, in this case Pharaoh, who is not acting freely because God has strengthened his heart? There are at least two ways of dealing with the problem. So here's two ways, two approaches you can take in answering this question when it comes up. One, God believed Pharaoh deserved to be punished. Had Pharaoh released the Israelites after a single plague, God would not have been able to adequately punish him and the Egyptian nation for the enslaving of Israelites for hundreds of years, for the mass murder of the infant boys, when all of them had to be thrown into the Nile if they were born male, all of which, it should be noted, they did out of free will, well before God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So Israel, the Egyptians had punishment due to them for what they had done for hundreds of years to the Israelites. The second point, strengthening Pharaoh's heart is precisely what gave Pharaoh free will. Had God not strengthened Pharaoh's heart, Pharaoh would have released the Israelites after one or at most two or three plagues. But such a release would have no more been an act of free will than it is free will when a man gives a confession while being tortured or signs a contract with a gun pointed to his head, as in the famous words from the novel The Godfather. I'll make him an offer he can't refuse. God's strengthening allowed Pharaoh to do what, in his heart, he really wanted to do, refuse to give up the slaves. Question number 8, is it okay to get angry with God? In Exodus 5:22, Moses is talking to God and he says, "Why did you send me?" Moses criticizes God for both making his mission unsuccessful and for sending him to Egypt in the first place. So again, the context here is Moses appears before Pharaoh. Pharaoh makes it a lot worse for the Egyptian or for the Israelites, where they have to gather straw. And so Israel is upset with him. Pharaoh's upset with him. And Moses comes back to God, you know, why did you send me? And the next point is that God does not become angry with Moses for his outburst. He understands that in the face of great evil, it can be very difficult to trust him or to understand his seeming passivity. God's non-reaction to Moses' outburst means all of us, not just Moses, are allowed to cry out against God when we're confronted with great evil, whether done to us or to others. It's important to recall the name of the Jewish people Israel means struggle or wrestle with God. I always remember the verse in Isaiah 1, where it says, "Come, let us reason together." So he goes on, of course, Moses' anger with God does not lead him to doubt God's existence. He had, after all, spoken with God at the burning bush. But Moses does doubt God will deliver on his promise to save the Israelites. His reaction illustrates two types of faith. One, faith in God's existence, and number two, faith in God's trustworthiness. Like Moses, we too can become angry with God and even doubt his trustworthiness. These are perfectly understandable responses to the reality of evil in the world. However, evil should not lead us to doubt God's existence. We need to be intellectually consistent. If the existence of evil argues for no God, then the existence of goodness must argue that there is a God. Point number 9, question number 9 in the top 10. Is there such a thing as collective guilt? The punishment inflicted on Egypt raised a difficult issue known as collective guilt. Specifically, was it right to punish the Egyptian people for decisions made by their Pharaoh? Is God fair or is God unfair? All that happened to Egypt, if Pharaoh's the one making the decisions, is it fair that all of Egypt was punished? He says, the Torah answer is yes, it is fair that all of Egypt was punished, because the evils inflicted by the Egyptians on the Hebrews were not inflicted by a few individuals, but by the Egyptian people. Though presumably not every single Egyptian over the course of centuries. The Torah made the collective nature of Egypt's participation in the enslavement, torment, and murder of Israelites clear in the first chapter of Exodus. The Torah also makes it clear, when it comes to individual crimes, as opposed to national crimes, evil is to be punished only on the individual level. Thus, if a family member or clan murders a member of another family or clan, it's expressly forbidden to punish the murderer's family or clan. That's one of the great moral advances inherent in the most misunderstood Torah law of an eye for an eye. Every punishment must be equivalent to the crime, not more, and must only be inflicted on the perpetrator, not his family. So when it's an individual sin, it should be the individual that is punished for it. When it's a collective guilt or collective sin by the whole nation, then we're going to see if Dennis's belief here is that the Torah says the whole nation should then be punished. When it comes to mass evil committed by a nation, there can indeed be collective guilt. We cannot deny national evil just because not every member of a nation was guilty. Take slavery in America. The whole American nation paid a terrible price, as the whole Egyptian nation did, because the national crime of African slavery. America fought its civil war because of slavery, a war in which as many Americans died as in all other American wars combined. A list that includes World Wars I and II, the Korean War, the Vietnamese War, over 700,000. A statistic particularly striking given America's population in 1860 was only 31 million. Of course, as in all wars, many of those most deserving of punishment, as such, in the case of African slavery, the slave kidnappers and traitors often got away with their crimes. In fact, according to the Torah, those individuals deserved the death penalty. At the same time, many innocents suffered and many died. The only perfect justice is in the world to come. Statements on slavery by two of America's greatest presidents affirm the notion of collective guilt. Thomas Jefferson, the third American president and the author of America's Declaration of Independence, warned that Americans will one day collectively pay for the sin of slavery. "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." So long before the Civil War happened, this president, Thomas Jefferson, predicted that the nation would be punished for slavery. During the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, too, offered America's collective guilt for slavery. And Abraham Lincoln wrote, "Fondly we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until every drop of blood with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword, as it was said 3,000 years ago, as it must be said, the judgments of the eternal are true and righteous altogether." So the idea that America's a crime of slavery, punishing with the lash, would be punished by the sword in the case of the Civil War, is something that Abraham Lincoln felt. And for number 10 of the top 10 questions coming from the commentary on the book of Exodus, the question is, do all believers in one God believe in the same God? We happen to be a group that has happened to have heard some messages on this theme. Interestingly, Adrian, in his debates with Muslims, addressed this exact question. You know, is the God of the Bible the same as Allah? Is Allah the God of the Bible? Was one of the themes of one of the debates. And so I think we happen to have a background in answering this question, But it's not uncommon that someone might come up and say, well, if you believe in God, and you know they believe in God, and so we all believe in the same God, and we all want good things for everybody, and so usually people that have no religious background will have this idea in their mind that everybody's good, and everybody believes in God, and it's all the same God. We're all going to the same place, and so when we are challenged with that, how do we address it? And then secondly, what does Scripture say about that subject? It says, this affirmation of God as the only God, the central tenet of the Torah, raises a vitally important question. Do all people who believe in one God believe in the same God? More specifically, do they all believe in this God of the Torah, the God that the Torah introduced to the world? The answer is, and this may come to a surprise, is no. That it's not, all religions don't believe in the same God. The reason this is so important is that God of the Torah is often blamed by anti-religious people for any terrible actions committed by anyone who claims to believe in God. So any religious person out there, whether they're Muslim or Christian or whatever, well, the acts of that crazy person, reflect badly on the one God. So people will accuse God when bad things happen. What they don't realize is that it's not the same God. There are different, different religions, different people have different views of God. When Jews, Christians, and Muslims, let alone people who identify with no religion, say, I believe in God, they're not necessarily talking about the same God, and certainly not necessarily talking about the God of the Torah. In fact, the statement, I believe in God, tells us nothing about a person's beliefs or about the God who he or she believes. To cite an obvious example, in a God whose name believers cut innocent people's throats, behead them, burn them alive, and rape girls and women, as being done at the same time as this writing by Islamic terrorists, in the name of the one God, cannot be the same God of the Torah, the God who gave the Ten Commandments, who commanded his people to love the stranger and demanded holy and ethical conduct at all times. Yet there are many people who argue, all those who say they believe in God believe in the same God. Why do people make this argument? Because all too often, they have anti-religious agenda. They say all those who claim to believe God believe in the same God in order to discredit God and religion, especially religions rooted in the Bible. So then, how are we to know whether any two people who say they believe in God believe in the same God, specifically the God of the Bible? So that's a question. How do you know if someone who says they believe God believe in the God of the Bible? What are some questions we might ask? We can find out by asking three questions. One, do you believe in the God known as the God of Israel? Before responding, some people might have to have the term defined. The God of Israel is a God introduced to the world by the Jews in their Bible. This is a God who created the world, who revealed himself to the Jews, who made his moral will known through the Ten Commandments and the Hebrew prophets. Obviously, all believing Jews would answer to the affirmative. The great majority of Christians would as well. If, after having God of Israel defined, a person cannot answer the question in the affirmative, it's fair to say the individual does not believe in the God of the Torah. He or she believes in another God. Another question, does the God you believe in judge the moral behavior of every human being and by the same standard, the same moral standard? There are many people today who say they believe in God, but not in a God who judges people's actions. Those people generally are to be found among those with no specific religion. For them, God is an entirely personal thing. Often they'll say, God is within me. But of course, if God is only within them, who outside of them will ever judge them? People who believe in God, a God who doesn't judge, morally judge them, and all other people, do not believe in the God of the Torah. They can be fine people, but the question here is not whether there's any good people that do not believe in God. Of course there are. The question is whether all people who say they believe in God believe in the same God, and specifically in the God that introduced by the Torah. The third question, do you believe in God who gave the Ten Commandments? This question also needs to be asked, even though it's included in the first question. The reason it needs to be asked is if God never revealed his moral law, how would we know what behaviors he demands from us and what acts he judges as wrong? None of these comments are a judgment of individuals. They're a judgment of the statement, I believe in God. There are people who do not believe in God of the Torah, and for that matter, people who believe in no God, who are fine, upstanding individuals. Just as there's people who believe in God that are not decent people. The best moral hope for mankind is to bring as many people as possible to a belief in the God introduced by the Torah. So in closing, I would recommend this as an excellent commentary. It's done by a conservative author, and I like the approach in where he has Bible verses that he's approaching, and he'll ask a question, and that question is then answered by the verses as he continues on. So it helps us as in our Christian life when people come and ask us questions to hopefully have an answer, which is one of the things that that we seek to have in our tool bag is answers for any questions that people have of us. So I hope we get a chance to chat later about your thoughts on.